All right. At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting are 1 year continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscious meeting. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Powers. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002, and Central is my home group. I say it every week that I go to every group conscious meeting as long as I'm in town because I want to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to know what's going on in my home group, and through my home group, I know what's going on in the district, the area, and GSO, and I want to be involved. Because when I first got here and I wasn't involved, I continued to drink, and I drank to the point where I almost killed myself, and I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be chairing this meeting. The group does ask me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off. Some of you don't know it, but we do record these speakers and put them on a website for free. And to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And now to introduce Ray. I met Ray when I first came in here and have kind of been somebody that kind of walked around and watched what he did, not just listened to what he said. And he's got a tremendous recovery program, I believe. And I was real lucky. You know, part of the fellowship here, when you get involved and get in the middle, is when Ray got married to Julie, I got a phone call. I was going to the wedding, but I got a phone call that afternoon, and he asked me, he said, the guy who's going to videotape my wedding can't make it. Would you mind videotaping my wedding? And I'm like, oh, my God, you're kidding me. And so he said, it'll only take a couple minutes. I'll show you how to do the camera. And sure enough, I went around, and I was videotaping. I was doing a storm, you know, having a great time. And sometime during the reception, some girl came up and said, how do I get a copy of that? And I just, without even thinking, some of you know me, without even thinking, I said, well, give Julie your name and the address, and I'll sell you one for $29.95. The next morning, I get a call from Julie. They're at the airport going on a honeymoon, and she says, you jerk, that was my sister. Anyway, here's Ray.
Everybody, my name is Ray Johnson. I am an alcoholic. Ray. My sobriety date is March 26, 1996, and the Jaywalkers is my home group. We meet at 7 p.m. on Tuesday nights at the Redeemer Lutheran Church over on Aloma, just east of 436. And then we celebrate birthdays once a month on the first Sunday of the month at 3 p.m. with an open speaker meeting like this one. And Jim, if you followed me around, then you must have made a lot of mistakes. Because I did, too, when I was first here. Now, I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was talking to Sheila earlier, and you know, it's really good now. It's better than it was a few years ago, And the interesting thing about that is I still have problems like money, house, job, car, kids, wife, health. I don't have a dog, so the cat has a problem. I have the same problems that I had years and years and years ago. The cool thing is today I have a solution that works under any circumstance in any given condition, and it's that solution is stated in the book, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea past this what's going to be said here. You know, when you sit there and you're in a meeting and you're waiting for it to come around to you and you start thinking in your head what you're going to say, you know, and like, it's really hard to do that for a 45-minute share. All right, I can get up to about a minute and that's it. After that, I lose track of everything. I was born in Germany, in Frankfurt, Germany, at the Air Force Base there. My father was in the military. My mother is full-blooded German. World War II, a lot of stuff there with her. And so I spent the first 14 years of my life mostly in Germany. My parents were not mean to us. I mean, I had a younger sister about a year and a half. And I was raised in a good German household, so there was always plenty of people, plenty of food, plenty of beer. And that's how I grew up. Now, the one thing that I didn't know when I was growing up was that I paid a lot of attention to what my father did. And I love him dearly. I don't blame him for anything of the way I am. Whether I inherited this disease through him or not, it doesn't really matter. What matters is I have it, and what matters more is what I do about it. And I watched him growing up, and I thought, you know, that's what I'm going to be. He was the in charge of the NCO club. Now, that means non-commissioned officers, and that's a club, and that's where you go to drink. He was in charge of the officers club. There was always alcohol in our home, always. I didn't know what AA was. I didn't know what alcoholic was. All I knew is that I wanted to be like that. And he had a lot of fun. They seemed a lot of fun. My mother and father were very social. They had a lot of parties. There was always something going on. But as I've heard a lot of people say, I felt kind of alone. Not unloved, but not the way I've heard a lot of people talk about their childhood. And again, it's irrelevant today. I've dealt with that, and it doesn't... I held no animosity towards my parents at all. I love them. I took my first drink when I was 14 years old. They were having a party down by the lake. This was after he retired, and we moved to a nice little place just south of here called Kissimmee. And back in the 70s, it was a little place. There was, 192 was two lanes. There was a Burger King and a McDonald's. Disney had just opened. I think Tupperware was here. And that was about it. So they're having a party, and a buddy of mine and went to his house, and we raided his father's liquor cabinet. We poured it all together in one big 2-liter bottle, and we drank it, and it tasted like crap. But man, the effect was amazing. The effect was pronounced. Growing up, I did good in school for the first, well, until I was 14. Things kind of changed after that. I did relatively good in school. I was pretty smart. I studied because I didn't have a whole lot else to do. I was kind of a loner. There were a few guys that I hung out with, but for the most part, I was a loner. And the same anxieties that I had when I was 30. To have the right car, the right girl, the right job, enough money, the right house. All of those anxieties. Of course, back then it wasn't anything about a house or a car. But it was about how I looked and what you thought of me. And that continued to haunt me well into, well, probably till last week. It was, if you're a guy and you ever remember being that young, I think you know what I'm talking about. You get to that point in your life where you're like, do I have what it takes? Well, as soon as I took that drink, I had what it took. And I had what it took for a long time afterwards until I realized that what I needed was nowhere near me, and I had no idea how to get to it. So I continued to drink through high school. I mean, Kissimmee was not, again, back then it was, bless you, it was not a big place. There were a few bars that amazingly are still there. I was down there a couple weeks ago, and they are still there. Place called Roscoe's, been there forever. There was a place on the corner of Thacker and 192 called, at one time it was the Big Daddy's, back when that was a chain, and then it turned to a place called Spanky's. And then there was a place across the bridge going down up toward Poinciana called the XYZ Package Store. And then there were a number of places that, you know, besides that we visited, but I mean, that's where I started to hang out. And back then, you know, fake IDs were irrelevant. You didn't need them. You could get in. They didn't really care. There was nobody there to stop you. And that's how I went through high school. How I got through there, it's still kind of a mystery. Because I didn't go to school. And the assistant principal, dean, whatever you call him, was on the phone to my father on a regular basis. Hey, I say, where's your son? He's not coming to school. Well, by that time, my father had moved out, and I was unsupervised, which is, well, that was kind of dangerous at that point. I barely graduated high school. At this point, it was daily. It was a party. I mean, that's how I looked at it. It was just a big party. And I didn't think about alcoholism or anything like that. It was just one big party, and it was fun. And I remember some of it. Some of it I don't. Every now and then, a little glimpse will come back. You know, that did that really happen or not? I don't remember for sure, but yeah, it sounded good, so maybe it did happen. And there was a lot of bad stuff that happened. High school, at that point, there was a place out on the turnpike. It's still there. It's called the Canoe Creek Service Plaza. And back then, it was kind of like a diner. And I got a job there. And I didn't really like the job, so I stopped going. But I needed the job because back in Osceola High School back then, they had this little program called, I called it work release. I think that's what it was called. I don't remember. But it amounted to, if I worked, I'd get my boss to sign this little piece of paper saying I'd worked, and if I got in a certain number of hours, I'd get a certain number of credits. And that's how I could, and that was the deal that the principal made with my father. He needs to work this long to get his diploma. Yeah. No. It lasted about a month. I said, you know, I'm done with this. Because I couldn't do what I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, where I wanted to do it, and who I wanted to do it with. And I stopped going. The lady that was my boss was really nice, though, and she liked me. And when it came down to brass tacks, I got her to sign the papers, and I managed to get my diploma in high school. So I don't know why she did that. And to rights, I probably really shouldn't have it. After that, it escalated to a point where I didn't want to do anything but drink and party. That's all I wanted to do. And I proceeded, I said, you know what, this is what I'm going to do for my life. I am going to be the best at this that I can possibly be. And if that means I'm walking barefoot with no car, no job, no place to live, along the road, trying to get money, trying to get somebody that can buy some booze, then that's what I'm going to do, because that must be the epitome of it. You know? And I continued to do that until I was 21 years old. My father had a little chat with me. Him and my mother were divorced by then. At this point, I had a couple cars repossessed. Whiskey bottles through windshields don't really provide much resale for a car. So I said, you know, take it away. I don't want to pay for it anymore. No sense of responsibility. Didn't really care about anything. And my father had a little chat with me. He said, look, I'll give you a job. You need to straighten out. And we'll go from there. So I did that. I got a job. I was a front desk clerk at a hotel in Winter Park called the Sheraton Inn. Well, they had a bar at the Sheraton Inn. And it was called the Saints and Sinners Lounge. I see a few of y'all are familiar with that place. It was a really good place. And I worked at the hotel that the bar was in. So there was no question of me walking over to the bar anytime I wanted to get a drink. And the bartenders knew me. They knew my father managed the place. So it was Party City all over again. I know a lot of y'all have a lot of DUIs. I appreciate that very much. I never got one. You probably got five or so that belong to me. Because I drove drunk nearly every day of my teenage and early 20s, and I never got caught. I don't know why. I know some of y'all have been through a lot more serious stuff than that because of drinking and driving, and that never happened. At least I don't think it did. There's a lot in my story that I just don't remember because it's gone. Back then, the law in Kissimmee, we knew them all. They all went to school with us. So the consequences, I used to think, even up to a few years ago, that there were never any consequences for when I drank back then. I was really grateful for that. I found out later that the consequences came much, much later in my life. They're still happening now. I'm still dealing with it. So, at that point, a lot of y'all know me, know my story. I've been married a couple, three or four times. I'm not going to beat around the bush. I got married, and my son was born, and my drinking and partying drove that relationship south in a heartbeat. She left, took my son, went back to a little island called Aruba, where she was from. Still there today. That relationship has not been healed yet, and he's 30-something years old, 32 years old, actually. So, you know, when you look at that list you have, that eight-step list about the amends you're willing to make, some of them take a while, but I'm willing to do it no matter what. That went south. So, I don't know at what point I crossed the line. I really don't. But I know that at that time, it was necessary to have a drink every day. It was necessary because I couldn't stand the pain anymore. I couldn't stand the shame. I couldn't stand the guilt. I couldn't stand the pain. I couldn't stand anybody looking at me. I couldn't stand it. And for a little while, it worked. For a little while, the alcohol would drive that away until it stopped working. And then it didn't really matter anymore. It didn't matter. I was 26 years old when I came to know Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. I was headed to California, the geographical cure, in a Mercedes. Who knows what was in the Mercedes? I don't know, but I was headed to California, and I was on a binge. I don't know, it was about 2 weeks long, and that night I thought I was going to die. I honestly did. And I remember laying on the bed, and I remember asking God, I said, God, I don't want to die. Well, see, prayers do get answered. It's interesting, though, because let me digress just for a minute. One of the things that has really taken me over the last few years is something that's said in the big book about the stories in the back of the book, that the stories describe how each of those people found their way to a relationship with a God that they understand or know. I would love for this talk to be about that, because without that, I would not be standing here. At that point in my life, I had no relationship with any kind of God. I thought of God just in case, if there was one, then I wouldn't be screwed. And if there wasn't one, then what's the difference? But at that point, I cried out, like many of you I've heard have. And I asked God, I don't want to die. And I didn't. And I wound up on an ex-girlfriend's doorstep. I got a problem. Immediately she called treatment centers, and before you know it, I was in a treatment center downtown Orlando called Magnolia Place. And I actually met somebody that was there at the same time I was a couple years ago. I was up in Sanford, and this lady had been there at the same time. So it wasn't a dream. It did exist. Because it was weird. It was a Tuesday, Thursday outpatient kind of deal. And the worst part was I had to go and sit down and talk to my parents and tell my parents what was going on. I hadn't been to work in over a month. And, my boss knew what was going on. But I had to walk in and sit down and tell him face to face. It didn't matter what he knew. It mattered what came out of my mouth and what I could admit to. And I admitted it to him. I said, yeah, this is what's been going on. And I agreed to go to treatment, and he gave me my job back. Of course, $6.25 an hour, it's all I could do. But I had a job. And I told my father that I would pay him back for the treatment costs. And back then, I don't know, it was $2,000-$3,000. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. Like 28 years ago. So I'm going to treatment Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I didn't know anything about AA. The only thing I remember about being called an alcoholic was some girl in a bar one night. I said something smart, and she said, you're a lot nicer when you don't drink. You're such an alcoholic. I'm like, yeah, I'm there. Because at that point, I just wanted to be in oblivion. I didn't want to know what was going on because it was too painful. I was too much guilt, too much shame. So about 3 weeks into this treatment, I remember sitting down with the guy's name was Scott. He was my counselor. And I had mentioned to him that And he says, you know, I've been gone. I mentioned to him, yeah, you know, I'm only having a couple beers every here and there. And he said, no. The point of this is that you stop drinking altogether. And I didn't really get that impression when I first went. I must have missed that part. Because I just want to kind of moderate. And that wasn't the case. It was complete abstinence. And all right, I don't want to go back to where I was. I want to get better. Because at that point, my girlfriend had taken me back. You know, so I'm going to do this for you. So I went to my first AA meeting on a Tuesday night at Magnolia Place. And it was a big room, and there's tables going all the way around the room, and all the people are sitting around the room, and they started, my name's blah, I'm an alcoholic. My name's blah, I'm an alcoholic. And it's going away from me at this point. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? I don't belong here. This is crazy. This is not a problem for me. And it came around to me, and it's interesting. I watched a TV show a couple of weeks ago about behavior. And how if you're in a group of people and people start doing something, you just kind of start doing it, right? And at that point, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to be the only one who says I am not an alcoholic, right? Because I am suffering greatly from the fear of what people think of me. I mean, it is to the core. I'm like, yep, I'm an alcoholic. Absolutely. Whatever you say. They handed me a big book, a 12 and 12, and a little black book. Third edition big book. Which I ended up never opened, of course. And so I stayed a few more weeks there. I wound up going to an AA meeting. If you ever go by Orange and Colonial, if you're going south on Orange, on the left-hand side, there's a little building there, and it says My Optics. It's an eyeglass dealer. Well, if you look up above that sign, there's a window up there because there's a little room up there, and there used to be an AA meeting up there. And that's where I would go. I think about four people showed up. And it was safe. And I never remember anybody talking to me about sponsorship. I never remember anybody talking to me about the big book or the 12 and 12 or the steps or the traditions or anything. It was one of those talk about what you want meetings. I managed to stay sober for a while. I went for about a year and a half. I got remarried. We had bought a little crack house over down in South Orlando somewhere, because that's what it was. It was terrible. And I thought, I got this. I got this together. And then my first daughter was born. And then my second daughter was born. And then right around the time of my second daughter being born, in 1995, I didn't have it. My life was terrible. There was no happiness. There was no peace. There was no serenity. All there was varying degrees of anger. That's how my life was. And I didn't understand. But I knew something. I knew what could make that go away. And I wound up picking up. And I didn't think twice about it. I said, you know what? I know this will go away if I do this. And it did for a little while. And when I say a little while, about a day. That's all. I had moved out of the house by then, and I was staying at my dad's place, and it was there. And I said, this will make it go away. It made it go away for that day. I tried to make it go away for about another year that way, and it wouldn't go away. None of my problems would go away. Nothing would go away. They were all the same and worse. Because I found out that even though I didn't drink at home, man, when I drank, I drank. And it was the same. Everything felt exactly the same as it did years before. I thought, I can't do this anymore. I know what the end result is. And I wound up crying out to God again. And I said, I need your help. I don't know what to do. Well, eventually, through, mysterious circumstances, he led me back here. And when I say here, I mean to that little building that used to be next door to here. I mean, I know a lot of y'all probably I've never seen it, but there used to be a little house right over here where the grass is green, and that little driveway is there. In fact, we pulled up tonight, and Eric parked there, and I looked at the, because I hadn't been here for a little while, and I looked at that driveway and said, oh man, they expanded the parking. And then I remembered, that's the driveway from the old house, from Central. And I wound up here. I was working with a guy, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I do. And I've learned a lot of that from him. And we were at work. We were working out one day, and I was complaining, and it was just terrible, and I was going to kill people. And, you know, he started to talk to me, and he said, you know what, Ray, you know, to thy own self be true. Now, funny enough, the first year that I was sober, or excuse me, the first year that I had stopped drinking, I really want to clarify, that means, I'm serious about that. I picked up a one-year medallion. And I looked at him, I said, you know what? I have that on a medallion at home, on the back side of it. He looked at me, he says, are you a friend of Bill W's? And I knew right then and there that I needed to be here. And he brought me to Central that night. Things did not change that quickly. He did introduce me to the idea of sponsorship. He did introduce me to the steps and the big book and the 12 and 12. And he did take me through the steps for the first time in my life. And my life got worse. At least that's how I looked at it, because none of what I wanted was coming back. You know, at that point, I was in the middle of another divorce. And that's a big history pattern for me. And I was dying. I hadn't had a drink in almost 7 years, and I was dying. I'm like, I don't understand. This isn't how it should be. You know, because I was still under the idea that stopping drinking was enough. I didn't understand the work that needed to be done with the other problems that I had, the problems that were the real problem, not just a symptom of the problem. And I remember going to this guy's office one day, dying. I mean, I was dying. And I sat there and I was crying. I was like, man, I don't know what to do, but I want you to be my sponsor. Now, at this point, we had been in a little book study up at a guy's house. It was about 12 or 13 guys. And that's where I met this guy. Not the first time, but that's where I got to know him. And I thought, you know, I got to understand the idea of, if you see somebody that has what you want, then go and talk to him. So I did that. And I remember exactly what he told me that day. He said, okay, there's three stipulations here. A, you don't drink before you get through the 12 steps. B, you follow my direction, period. C, you got to go talk to your sponsor you have right now and tell him. I'm like, I'm good with A and B. I'm not too sure about C, because that means I had to go and admit to somebody. I was scared to death, because, again, I am just wrought through with what you think of me. But at this point, I was at a point of surrender. I didn't care. I would do whatever it took. And I went, I remember talking to the guy, and he said, dude, no problem. And I remember showing up at the Central Picnic just a few days later, and him and my new sponsor were there talking to each other. I'm thinking, holy crap, man. What in the hell is going on? This is just too weird. But you know what? I was willing. If you're new and somebody tells you that it's a good idea to do something, they've been around for a little while and they seem to have it, listen to them. It could mean the difference between life and death for you. I thought that it did for me. It changed my life. So we did that. We went through the steps as outlined in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life started to change. My problems didn't really go away. How I approached them changed. I remember the first time that we did the third step prayer, and we did the third step prayer, and he said, you know, your life is no longer any of your business. All right. Okay. I really didn't have a clue what that meant, but I didn't care. I know what it means now. Because back then I thought the third step meant that I had a God in place, ready to take over, I'm out of the way, and I had nothing near that. There was no God in my life that I had any clue of. But I was willing to believe that there was one. And I believed. And this guy shared his with me. And he showed me, not in the book, but he showed me through action on what to do. And through doing that stuff, which it says in the book, it's called love and service, that you will find a God that you can relate to. I didn't have faith. I mean, there was a measure of faith. There was hope there for me at first. There was just hope, because the true faith that I have today didn't come just like that. It came from doing the work. It came from going to meetings and chairing meetings and working with other drunks. It came from doing the work. And when I watched the results, the faith grew, because I saw that it was true, that everything he told me was true. That if I'm willing to do whatever it takes for victory over alcohol, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes for victory over all the other stuff in my life, that I can change that with God's help. It's none of my doing. There's no virtue of mine. Trust me on that. It's all, everything in my sobriety is directly as a result of my relationship with God. He showed me how to do stuff through the sponsors that I've had in my life. And when my relationship with God changed, wow, the whole world started to change. Now, I still had the same problems. And Julie and I got married, and now you got two alcoholics in the house. And problems are still there. You know, that some of that just, it's tough. But I keep going back to what I learned, and that is the answer is in the book. The answer is always in the book. There's a spiritual solution for all of my problems. It says it in the book. And I lean on that heavily for every little thing in my life today. I mean, everything. It's not just, all right, the big stuff is yours, I can handle the little stuff, because the little stuff is what eats my lunch. The big stuff, don't drink. I got that. Don't try to run the guy in front of you off the road because he cut you off. I have trouble with that. Okay, it's those kinds of things that really cause me trouble. And I don't, we went to the convention a few months ago, and we heard Sandy B and Bob D, and the whole deal was the goal today is to be the least disturbed. And I like that, because after I really heard that and I really started to look at my life, I am disturbed a lot by the stupidest crap. And I, in turn, help others to get disturbed because of that. I don't want to be the carrier of disturbance. I want to carry love and that kind of stuff. And it's hard, because instinct in me says, do this, do this, do this. And the book says, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And God says, that's not a good idea. Of course, he says that to my sponsor. And what do? I follow my instinct. And I do that. And that was not a good idea. It's not as bad as it used to be. I can tell you that much. Staying sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to work the steps into my life does not get easier for me. It actually gets a little harder. Because every time I go through a four-step, and I just went through one, the same problems are there. The same nature of my wrongs are always there. They just show up in subtler forms. That's all. Dishonesty, selfishness, self-seeking, fear, they just show up in different ways. Because it's like, it's warfare, I guess. I figure out, okay, I got that one, and it creeps in there and shows me it in a different way. So I have to be ever vigilant. The one way that happens is working with other alcoholics. Because when I'm going through the book with somebody else, I get to see my stuff all over again. When I go through a fifth step with somebody else, I'm pretty sure there's something that comes to my mind that I need to call my sponsor about. Every single time. The rest of the steps give me a way to address that. In the 12 and 12, it says in step 6 that this is the one that separates the men from the boys or the women from the girls or however you want to put it. I like to be fair. And I love that because, maybe it's masochistic, I don't know. But it means that everything in my life today, everything, material, relationships, people, or whatever, is God's, not mine. It means that at any minute he can say, change of plan, I'm taking this away. As it says in step 7. Because there are relationships that I have that I think are really good that are not good for me. And he does not hesitate to point those out. There are things that I do that I think, wow, that is so... I don't know the word for it. So good, so helping, so service-oriented. In reality, they're based on self-seeking and ego and what you think of me or what I want you to think of me. And those things are so difficult to root out sometimes for me. And that's why I need a sponsor to help me do that. That's why I need people around me that are of like mind, who believe in the book and the program, which is the steps, that can help me sort through that crap. Because, you know, I don't always get my sponsor on the phone on the first try. But I got a group of men that I can call any one of them and say, look, this is what's going on. And they'll say, hey, did you look in the book on page 53 or something like that? And I'm like, okay, I'll go look. Or the 12 and 12. I mean, the information in those books is priceless. As long as I can use it. I need somebody to help me do that. I can read pretty good. Understanding is a whole different story. You know, because I can take what's written and turn it and twist it and mold it into what I think it should be. And as it says, my mind lacks proportion and my thinking is not straight, or something to that effect. And it's true today. I'm thinking something like, what are you doing? Where is that coming from? It's coming from some thought of mine that I think one of my instincts is being unfulfilled. And again, today, it's not as bad as it used to be, but that one instinct, the one instinct of being somebody in society, you know, being somebody amongst my peers, what you think of me haunts me. And it crops up. And I wish there would be a day when I would stop having to deal with that. And I'm sure that day will come. It might be the end of the day for me. You know, it might be the day where I go up to God and God says, guess what? You don't have to deal with that anymore. And I'll say thank you, because it is brutal. So when I talk to guys that struggle with that, and about everyone I talk to does, I have some experience in that, and I can pass that on. I don't have an experience on how to go to court with a DUI. I don't. I have experience on how to go to court for a divorce. I can help you with that. I am not that good at relationships. I probably can't help you much with that unless you want to know what not to do. But then again, I've made some progress in that area. Yeah, every bit of this is a direct result of my relationship with God. And it is not because of anything I do, it's because of how good He is. Mm-hmm. That He chooses to shower grace upon anybody who will receive it. And that's what it is. It's nothing but grace. Julie and I read in the morning, and we read out of a couple, three different books, and we pray together. And I try to start every prayer with thank you, because I am so grateful for my life today. And if you read it in a book on details, you might go, wow, you belong here because you're nuts. Okay, there's no way you should be grateful for that. That's not it. It's the idea that in calamity I find serenity. And that is from God. That is not from anything I do or anything I read. It is God's grace. I don't know when it happened. I don't really care when it happened. All I know is it's unending, and I can go at any time when I'm in pain. I can go at any time when I'm not in pain, which is more important for me. And I try to express that to the guys that I work with, because the answer is there. The object of the book is to put me in touch with a higher power. I think the book succeeded for me. And I know a lot of other men that it succeeded for. I know a lot of women that it succeeded for. So, if you're new and somebody suggests open the book, I would take that suggestion. And once you get through that stuff, and somebody comes up to you and says, wow, you know, that stuff that they talk about called the traditions, I would highly recommend that you take a look at them. You know, a lot of people say, well, that's for the group. It'll help you to play well with others. It really, really will, especially if you go to business meetings. Because business meetings can be difficult. Because I can be difficult, I know that. I have an opinion just like everybody else. And one of the things that I've learned today is to respect other people's opinion and respect the fact that they have one. Doesn't make me right or them wrong or them right or me wrong. It's just different. And when you get in a relationship, which you all will or have, and that opinion thing comes up in your relationship, it's really, really important that you respect the fact that they can have an opinion. But it's really important that I stand up for what I believe is true. And I try to do that today. Until God says, that's not true. And then I'll do something different. Really, it's relationships are the hardest part of being alive for me. Because I'm not good at them. The book tells me I'm not. So, Jim, thank you again for asking me to come and talk. There's hope in this room. God is in this room. And I hope when you walk out of here, you feel that. Thanks a lot.